I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Bend a Table, a monthly food subscription service for avid home cooks focused on delicious and sustainable pantry items. Learn more at bendatable.com. That's BENTOTABLE.com. And when you use code HRN for a new subscription, you get $20 off, and we at HRN get 10 bucks.
Oh, Jesus.
Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Zoom from the Lower East Side. Nastasia Lopez, as usual, from Stamford, Connecticut. How you doing, Nastasia?
Good.
Yeah. I was real nervous because when they booted up the sound, it was like it was playing at like Barry White half speed and sounded kind of like real twerked, whatever it's called, chopped and screwed. But I feel like we're back to normal, so we're okay. We got Matt, what booth are you in? Are you in the Rhode Island booth or in the Brooklyn booth?
Brooklyn booth, and that's an exciting development that it plays at a weird speed for you guys. Don't even want to think about that right now.
I definitely don't want to think about it. So we have a special show. We have a bunch of guests today. So, you know, Nastasia, you've known him for a while. I've, you know, met him a couple times, but the guest for today is Adam Leonti. But Adam Leonti, you there, Adam?
I'm here.
Not just a well-known chef. Worked, your first big job was what, with Mark Vetri or?
Yeah, I was with Vetri for about 10 years.
Yeah. So chef, but then somehow like went into the world of first through pasta, right? But then into bread, and then also into milling your own flour via like some sort of like work that you did for a couple of years in Italy, right? So it's like this kind of long road, but you've become one of the gurus of the mill your own flour and bread baking movement. Would you say that's accurate?
That is accurate.
Yeah. So you wrote Adam's book, the Flour Lab, no relation to the food lab, by the way. The Flour Lab is came out in 2019, and I think no one really expected it. But with the COVID, there's been an explosion in interest in kind of home milling. So Nastasia and I contacted Adam to be on the show, and then it turns out that he had his own idea. So, here is what Adam wants to do, for those of you that are listening. Adam wants to do a show that is a mashup of kind of car talk for bakers, but like 3 a.m. like cable access, love line call-in kind of a situation. Would you say that's accurate?
That is accurate. I get a lot of desperate messages early in the morning, and so I thought it was only appropriate for the time.
Right. So now we can't really have callers in here, now because we're not like, you know, we just don't have that capability right now. So what we did was we're doing a test run of Adam's like poker after dark bread baking love line situation in Cooking Issues. And we've gotten people to write in the questions. And then Nastasia has some of her friends, her friends, who are going to read the people's questions as though they were calling you at 3 a.m. to answer these things, right?
Perfect.
All right. So, by the way, before we get started, I know that, you know, probably our listeners aren't like this, but Adam's bread, just if you hadn't had it, Adam's bread is extremely delicious. I'm just going to go ahead and say that it's extremely delicious. And it kind of the first time I had it, because the Brooklyn Bread Lab, which is where I first tasted your bread, is right near Roberta's pizzeria. So we stopped after the radio show a couple years ago, and we got a loaf. And I know you're no longer there, but at the time you were, you gave us a tour. I tasted a loaf, and it kind of changed my whole mental attitude of what a whole wheat loaf could be, even kind of what a sourdough Levant loaf could be, and kind of like the what freshly milled flour can do for you, because he had this mill in the center of the lab. He was making the flour and then baking the bread. And the bread was, you know, as a kid of the 70s, like whole wheat was kind of this dense, like kind of terrible thing that people ate kind of for health reasons. And things that were considered sourdough were typically rather like they'd come from slack doughs because they'd gone overly acidic and the kind of structure had been lost on the inside and they had a chew and a crust to match that, right? Like an acidic dough would have. And this was none of those things. It was incredibly delicious, like amazing crumb structure, great taste. And I was like, I gotta learn how this guy makes this bread this way. So that's, you know, that's why I was interested in reaching out to have you on the show. So that's just a...
He's also making bread at Sophia's constantly. So you can still get it.
Nice. All right. So anything you want to say before we start this or no?
I think that was a great introduction. I mean, you kind of covered it all. So let's go for it.
All right. And then after this, I'll pester you with my questions from your book and we'll talk about my misadventures in flour milling. By the way, those of you who are old like me and tried milling flour in the past with some things like, let's say, a KitchenAid grain mill, like that's if you have ever used one of those grain mills, maybe that's why you don't like grinding flour because they are garbage.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the KitchenAid Corporation, but those things are garbage. Anyway, we'll talk about it later, unless you're brewing beer, in which case it's fine. Okay, so the first question in is going to be, and it's about sourdough, is going to be from Harry Cuthbertson, and it's going to be read by Mike Van Dorn, friend of the show, Boondoggler's fiance and adult diaper expert. Mike, go.
Hey, Dave, the hammer, Matt and Pants, Adam, and any others that I've missed. I'm a pastor and a chef from Tasmania, Australia, and I'm the stereotype for your show. I'm 36, white, male, married. I buy too much kitchen equipment, but my wife's cool with it, and it's a tax write-off. Wink. I bake sourdough at home with local but commercially available baker's flour. It's pretty stock standard flour. Is there any real benefit to milling at home? Is it worth the hassle? The bread I'm currently baking is good, but how much better could it get? Thanks for your show. You guys are the best. Seems like New York is coping a massive pummeling from this COVID-19 virus. You guys are in my prayers. Cheers, Harry C.
All right. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe folks from Tasmania really love coffee. And kind of the same idea applies from coffee to milling your grains is a lot of folks are used to having maybe, you know, in their youth, something pre-ground for coffee every day. But as soon as you start to get, you know, into the more modern era of espresso and your little espresso bar from down the street, you realize when they mill it to order, it kind of makes all the difference. So if you're going to improve your bread and you're already happy with it, if you add in a portion of fresh milled flour, it definitely has the same effect. It just doesn't oxidize, and therefore all the flavor is there for when you put it into your dough.
Well, let me see what you think about this, Adam. So it's like having just tested, because I'm sure you don't go out and bake bread anymore with, you know, flour that you buy at the store, right? But Dax has been, right, Dax has been baking bread. Primarily he's doing the Jim Leahy No Need bread, right? But he's been baking it with, you know, relatively decent, you know, flour, AP Heckers, and it's good, right? The texture of it's good. We let it, you know, we retard it in the fridge for a couple, it does a slow rise for like 24 hours, then we retard it in the fridge for a couple of days, so it, you know, builds up some flavor. It's good, you know what I mean?
Sure.
But then when we used first some relatively recent stuff milled by somebody else, but when we started milling our own warthog, which is the wheat we're using, it's like you're like, oh, all of those flavors that are things that you need to hide that are off flavors when the stuff's been milled and sitting around for a long time with the germ and the bran and it oxidizing, those are actually things that you crave and love if you use it right after you mill it, right? Wouldn't you say that's true?
100%. Couldn't agree more.
So, I mean, like, let's not, like, bread made from flour, if you make good bread, is going to be delicious, but there are these other flavors, and I think this is where, like, the coffee thing really comes through. There are these other flavors that, in general, you see as bad things in kind of old, stale, commercially milled flour because they are bad at that point. They've been ruined. They've been oxidized.
They've gone rancid. Yeah, exactly.
Right. But when you have them fresh, they're great. And so I think that's the difference. So, I mean, as a recent convert, because I just got a decent grain mill up working, if you have time, I think it's good. Anyway, so I guess we have also, who's up next? Okay, so longtime listener of the show, Capri Sun. Capri Sun's question will be read by Jordana Rothman, friend of the show, a long time. She likes to pummel us. So we use Peter Kim as our punching bag, and then Jordana comes in and punches on us pretty much.
Why haven't people pushed the tuning and development of home grain mills to the extent that has taken place with current high-end espresso grinders? Does it just not matter in the final product? Loaf of bread, shot of espresso?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is in the word espresso, meaning like express, really fast. To have your result, you know, end up in about 30 seconds from an espresso is immediately gratifying, where bread making inherently is a long process. Even the shortest made or time to make bread is still at least 45 minutes. So a lot of folks aren't all that patient. I think one of the reasons why bread baking has taken off so much since we've been in quarantine is that there's a lot of time on folks' hands. So it's not that the milling isn't, it's not worth it for flavor. Absolutely worth it for flavor. It's just that the time that's needed to then make bread after milling. The milling only takes a few seconds or maybe a few minutes if you're going to make what.
You're not using a home mill if it only takes a few seconds, dude.
A few minutes if you're doing it at home, maybe 10 or 15, you know, not too bad. But certainly not as quick as it is for just a few ounces of coffee, like an espresso.
I'll give another thing on this as well, is that if you go back in time, if you, you know, are old enough to go back in time to like 2001, 2002, like nobody had commercial espresso machines or grinders at home. Nobody. And, you know, the kind of the height of home espresso making at the time was the La Pavoni Europiccolo hand press machine, right? And there were websites devoted to, you know, how to try to get the best professional shot out of your Europiccolo. And, you know, the best grinders that you could get at home were these kind of burr grinders. Kind of with the advent, and espresso wasn't that huge a deal, frankly, in the United States either. Like, you know, none of the huge stuff had really hit here. Like on the West Coast in Seattle, you had, you know, Schomer and Vivace, and you had other people who were starting like the rumblings of the kind of espresso revolution here, but it hadn't happened. What happened is a bunch of rich people started buying commercial espresso equipment at home. And then, you know, people who weren't rich, like myself, started buying commercial espresso stuff used on eBay. And there was already a big market for commercial espresso grinders and commercial espresso machines, like for espresso bars. And once big companies realized that there was this next tier of idiots like me who wanted this kind of like semi-pro crap, then that semi-pro crap, which was just dumbed down versions of the commercial stuff, became available, like the Rancilio Rocky grinder, which I still use to this day. So I think another reason is that there was this whole tier of things that could be dumbed down to home use. And Adam, you were actually talking to these mill people saying that they should hit the pros. If a bunch of pros have it, then eventually it'll trickle down to the home jerks like myself, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was really the idea when I started talking to folks from different mill companies, was if we can get it into a commercial kitchen and people start to talk about it at that level, then it can trickle down, exactly.
Yeah, because what you don't understand, what most people don't understand as not manufacturers, is that the cost to make like 100 mills, mock mills, is like per mill is extremely high. Now, if you were making, you know, 15,000 of them a year, then the price drops considerably. Also, the amount it costs you as a seller to sell each individual one, because your salary is going to stay pretty much the same, the cost to sell each one of these units goes way down, and things can become cheaper. They can become more reasonable. You can use different kinds of tooling, different kinds of manufacturing. You can get it much cheaper. So it's very hard to market something inexpensively unless you're making a lot of them, you know?
Anyway. Absolutely.
All right, now we have a friend of the show, a deep voice master, and our favorite Grinch stand-in for every Christmas episode, Phil Bravo, to read a question. And we had this for you, Adam, because I know that you are a lover of olive oil and a lover of things Italian. So he's going to read Ashmeet Jaitley's question.
Hey, Dave and the Issues Gang. I have a question about olive oil. Now, it's going to be inflammatory for some people, so prior discretion. I think that olive oil is not that intrinsically superior than most oils in the market. I'm not talking about the health aspects, which, honestly, I don't and you don't care about, but the actual taste of it. The extremists evidently enjoy the taste of raw olive oil by itself. Now, I get that that could be nice with like a reduced tomato sauce or something, but just in its raw form, unaided, it's so overpowering and tannic to me. As a North Indian, I am obviously not that exposed to it, which might explain my dislike. I much, much prefer ghee or, if anything, mustard oil in my cooking. Now the question is raw olive oil really that great? Am I just an outlier or is it not? And there are cultural and historical factors at play, or both in some sense. Also, I've tried converting myself by daily tasting 10 grams of raw EV olive oil by itself for 1 month, just in case I might eventually like the taste of it. And the result is that I hated myself for that period. Thank you, and hope you all stay well. And so sorry for this question being this long.
Well, that's an easy one. Well, you know, obviously flavor is and taste is subjective. However, I think sticking with the theme of freshness, I think fresh olive oil certainly is something that's not available to everyone. And if you're going to go about your objective tasting, maybe start with something that was also freshly put on a stone mill, much like the wheat. In Italy, a lot of times it's just in November when they start to press it and you get this really bright, fruity flavor, but you also have to consider just how many varieties of olives there are. So perhaps the olive oil that, you know, you're tasting isn't the variety that's for you. So I would certainly try to exhaust those options before you write it off. I think a majority of the population of the Mediterranean would agree that the olive oil is maybe not superior, but certainly the oil of choice for the table. And if that's not quite enough to convince you to keep, you know, researching, if you go down a YouTube hole of Turkish oil wrestling, which is all on the western side past Istanbul, you should get into some olive oil after that. So that's my answer.
So my two cents on this one is I'm going to give you a little bit in the sense that if you're going to heat the oil, like a lot of its like taste properties, and you're right, I don't care about the health properties, the supposed health properties, are kind of obliterated by high heat. And as Adam says, if you don't like the taste of the olive oil, then by all means, use something else. But I mean, I just happen to love the taste. And the way to learn to love olive oil isn't to taste it on its own. Because also, frankly, like if you take a spoon, where the olive oil hits you on the tongue and how you inhale air afterwards is going to radically change. Like you could have a sample of oil, hit it, you don't get a lot of pepperiness, and then you hit it, but you inhale a different way or it hits a different part of your throat and mouth, and you'll get an entirely different sensation of that oil. And this brings it back to the episode. The best way to taste olive oil is on bread. And I have to say, olive oil on bread with salt is right up there with butter on bread with salt as two of my favorite things to eat. So, I mean, I would kind of try it. That way as something, but it's definitely a condiment. You know, I think there's very few dishes that require it. Yeah, finishing oil for sure. But I mean, there's certain kind of pastries that kind of require that olive oil to really be themselves. And there's you know, the famous olive oil ice gelato. But I get your point. If you don't like it, don't use it. Right, Adam, or no?
100%. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think the part of the answer the was in the question when he was talking about with a reduced tomato, that kind of goes to what you were saying. It's a good condiment. You know, if something's very acidic, it's really nice to have something that's sort of fat and voluptuous to counter it. So certainly have it with items. I don't think it's probably the best showing of just walking around drinking it by itself.
Yeah. Also, I will say this one last thing. Sorry, but like the olive oil kind of the evil empire of olive oil hegemony is run by the Italians, right? And the Italians in general, for their judging, often favor extremely green, extremely raw tasting, biting, heavy phenolic kind of oil. Not phenolic. You know what I mean? Like biting, yeah, kind of tannic oils. They really favor that, right? And so kind of the more throat ripping, the better. And one of the reasons, as Adam pointed to, is because that throat ripping stuff goes away as olive oil sits around. So even before an oil becomes rancid and actually becomes destroyed, it will lose some of that fresh, green, biting kind of flavor. And hence it is prized. There are many cultures around the Mediterranean who make, and you know, also in California and also in Australia, who make olive oil that doesn't fit those criteria, and yet the judging is still based around that. So perhaps you prefer one of the more quote unquote buttery olive oils, because there are a lot of olive oils that have a lot of flavor but aren't huge throat rippers. That said, I love a throat ripping olive oil, but that's me. You know what I mean? You know, Ad, what do you think? Anything more? You think we're good on this?
Yeah, one? No, that's definitely true. I remember spent a little bit of time in Spain when I was living in Italy and would visit Spain. And some of those olive oils were much fattier, which was really surprising, a little less throat ripping. But then it kind of made sense with what we were eating, because the food was actually a little bit more throat ripping on its own end. There was more spice involved. There was a little bit more, you know, picante style heat, you know. So an olive oil didn't really need all those characteristics, and you could see that definitely in the food and how they were making their olive oil. So yeah, certainly cultural. That's a good way to look at it.
Also, Anastasia like must be loving this format, because she hasn't said squat. How many pairs of shoes have you bought on Zappos?
I'm just keeping everybody in line that's waiting on you to finish the question so that they can read their questions so they can get on with their day.
But what's with the snark on the waiting the question getting on with their day? The job is to answer the questions.
I know.
That's
it's
the
just
job.
Like it's a volley
that's
between.
That's the job. Anyway. All right.
As long as, okay, well, I'm just waiting for you to have the last word on the question, and then I'm like, okay, get ready. It's your turn.
But I can tell them when it's their turn. They can hear me say their name. Watch
yes,
how this
but
works.
Some people zone out.
Okay. Now, the next person reading a question, I know her, but I don't know her well enough to jab her or make fun of her. So I will just say who it is. Reading that fan off of Instagram's pizza question will be Rachel Prisgoda.
Why is a 60 to 90 second pizza bake different from 3+ minutes, et cetera? Is it because there's less time for moisture to escape the dough, or something else?
That's the easy one. That comes from Naples, the city of Naples, which is where my grandmother's from. That's a very specific dough cooking method to a town that has made its own system and hierarchy of pizza. Really what it does is it leaves a dough that's wet and kind of soupy. A lot of people actually really don't care for it when they look at it over, say, a New York pizza. I used to go to Naples maybe once a year and would bring someone with me that had never been. And they're always so surprised on how quickly it was baked and how unsatisfying it was to them. I think it's really interesting. I love when I'm down there to try it, but it's really a preference. In those ovens also, just to give it a little bit more than just the flavor or how it's culturally made, they're very hot. You know, there's somewhere between 650 and 800 degrees Fahrenheit. So one of the things is to get the dough in and out as quick as possible to get another pizza sold, because it is a business and it's also an inexpensive food in Naples. So it's something to have for lunch and not necessarily, and I'm sure I'll get in trouble for this, but don't take it too seriously. Just kind of eat it and go among, you know, about your day afterwards. They're usually like 5 to 10 euro for what would be like $30 here. But you get a big burst of heat, which makes all the CO2 in the dough expand really quickly. So you get like the big outside cornuto, the little corn on the outside, the little holes. That comes from high heat. And then you just get that soft interior. It's really more stylistic than anything. You could take those doughs and bake them differently. You could bake them longer. You could get them crispier. And it would just taste different. And maybe you would like it or maybe you wouldn't.
And in your book, Adam, correct me if I'm wrong, but in your book, you give different recipes for different styles of pizza dough. And a lot of it has to do not just with the place. So you have a Neapolitan, you have a Roman one and a Connecticut one, which if we have time, we could talk about later. But then you talk about how the dough, and not just the flour, which you talk about a lot as well, but that's, you know, getting in deep for people who aren't going to do their own milling, but how the hydration changes depending on the oven that you're using and how the heat is applied. And that's not something I think that a lot of people talk about in non-pizza specialist books anyway.
Yeah. Tried to get the idea across, because if you're going to bake in your home oven to achieve something that tastes professional, you're going to have to kind of deal with it. I provide the recipe so that way you don't have to actually like create your own recipe, but to get an understanding that with a lower temperature or something that's not maybe also equipped with a heavy stone, which helps keep heat regular and kind of the same throughout the whole time that you're baking, you have to mess with the hydration to kind of mimic your favorite style, because the style that you're into or whoever is into, to achieve it, you're going to have to mess with the water, because it's going to be relative to the amount of time that's in your oven. So to have a Neapolitan style pizza in your house, you're going to have a higher hydration. It's going to ferment also a long time to also counteract that doughiness, that quick bake. So you're not really eating quote unquote raw flour. You're eating something that's been digested by yeast for a long time. So it's easier for it to bake, easier to digest. And also it just mimics that feeling that maybe you had in Naples. When you have like a Detroit pizza, that's something that's baked in a pan. So inherently it's going to be slower because the pan's going to be cold. It's something that you're going to have to form in the pan and then put in the oven, so you're gonna have to kind of change for that effect on the time there. So that's going to be, you know, closer to 30 minutes really for something like that to bake, kind of like a baked pasta. And then the other things are the water in the dough is going to determine how the dough stretches. More water, generally speaking, makes it easier and more elastic, the dough. So for Connecticut pizza, those are big pizzas. They're not the little 350 gram dough weight. They're much bigger. They're like 20 something inches. So you need a little bit more water in there too, so you can stretch it, which is kind of interesting. So they all have an effect based really on what you're trying to achieve and the pizza that you're into. So it really comes down to style. And pizza is, I would say, the food item that the people I know are most comfortable with getting in a fight about. People love to argue about pizza in my experience. So,
yeah, just so people know, like some of your pizza recipes are like up like almost 90% hydration. And then some of them are as low as like 56, 60% hydration. So he's really pushing the hydration different directions based on what you want, right? Like you're Pizza Romana is looking at like 56 or 60% hydration.
Yeah, exactly. Because those pizzas that you see in the windows in Rome are kind of like, I mean, pizza and bread are very much almost the same thing. And those are a little bit more bread-like, a little bit, they're not as thin, you know, they're not as delicate. They're slightly more hearty. And that effect comes from having the lower hydration in it.
This episode is brought to you by Bend a Table, a monthly food subscription service for avid home cooks focused on delicious and sustainable pantry items. And here I am. I'll open up my box. Let me see here. It comes with a Delicacies France and an Essentials. I got Fleur to Sel. Now, Fleur to Sel. Now, this is from, I swear to God, M. Gilles Hervé. And then I got Rancho Gordo's classic cassoulet bean. I love cassoulet. It says, a beautiful white runner bean developed by French farmers over generations to be the foundation of the classic cassoulet. Now, I have never made a cassoulet with the official bean before. I better hurry up and cook it, though. It's going to get too hot for cassoulet soon. Finally, Christmas lima beans, which I don't know anything about. All the meat of a conventional lima with a chestnut flavor, bold enough to handle chilies, curries, or just a drizzle of olive oils. I'm interested in that. I've never had this before. It does not look like the kind of green lime as we have. It is white, and it kind of looks like a drawing, like a wood block cut of like wood and grain. It's got a real kind of cool look to it. All right, looking forward to cooking with it. Go to bendatable.com to start your own monthly subscription. Use the discount code HRN to get $20 off a new subscription, and Bend a Table will donate $10 to support cooking issues and all of HRN's programming.
All right, next question in is from Aaron Melville and will be read by Jordana.
It may be worth mentioning how much the quality of the flour can influence the pasta taste. I didn't fully appreciate this until I moved to Emilia-Romagna from the U.S. The pasta, dried and especially fresh, can be so flavorful and varied here in Emilia-Romagna, where I live now. Supermarket flour can be very good here in Italy, where I live as well, but there are particularly fresh and excellent flours from small, local, Italian, of course, producers that can change the taste of the pasta dramatically. Of course, I'm sure plenty of good producers are in the US that may be worth seeking out, but I wouldn't know because I live here in Italy.
Hmm. All right, what do you have to say to Aaron / Jordana?
Well, there is a certain amount of romance that goes in with pasta, and oftentimes with bread dough starters. People like to name their starters, but pasta is also something that the, you know, provenance of the flour sometimes evokes certain feelings and nostalgia. And the reason I mention it is because the reality is that a lot of Italian brands in Italy, serving in Italy, get their grain or even already pre-milled flour from the U.S. So that is something that, you know, is oftentimes confusing, but the arable land in the U.S., especially for grain, is many times larger than like the entire country of Italy, which is pretty incredible when you think about it. If you go all the way down from Utah up to Canada, you know, that's a very large area, mostly growing wheat. So Italy buys a lot of it from the U.S. They also buy it from Australia and Ukraine. So it's not always the effect of it being grown in Italy, but maybe the Italian standard on what it is they stock their shelves with. So the properties that, you know, these Italian producers are, you know, looking for is probably a little bit more flavor driven. So when they make a wheat kind of compilation, so when you buy an all-purpose flour, there's usually 7 or more, sometimes 11 different wheats that go into what makes an all-purpose, which would be 00 in Italy. And in the U.S., we might choose our combination for strength and to make it more foolproof to bake at home. In Italy, The double zero is oftentimes selected for flavor in addition to the other properties of maybe elasticity or protein. So if you're getting something from a local mill in Emilia Romagna, that's great. In the U.S., if you're lucky enough to live generally near bigger cities because they have a larger market, farms will bring their grains and flours there. But small towns often sometimes have less options. You know, we're lucky in New York to have a lot. And in Italy, when I worked in Italy, we actually used all of our flour came from a mill right in town. It wasn't just a few miles away from the restaurant. I hope that answers the question.
By the way, you're reminding me at the end of the show, hopefully we have time, you know, Matt will remind us, but Nastasia hates fresh pasta. So I want fight, fight. Anyway, Wally from New Orleans has the next question. This one will be read by Mike Van Dorn.
Like everyone else, I'm trying to make bread again, but like the last 5 years of attempts, I still can't get that Leidenheimer thin crust, light crumb that lasts exactly 12 hours before it needs to be used in bread pudding or crumbs, po' boy loaf, actually pistolettes. I've had some nice looking loaves since I piped steam in them from the pressure cooker. It's a great spring, but the crumb is still leaden. I found a banh mi recipe that looks doable, but it calls for bread enhancer. Well, there is a run on that too. What does it do and what can I substitute it for? I found lecithin, citric acid, wheat gluten. Also, I was robbed last week buying a pound of fresh Saf instant gold dust. Ah, yeast! As the block that I bought in the Bahamas 3 years ago seemed a little tired, although it was only open for two. Any other advice other than go visit the family in New Orleans?
By the way, for those of you that don't know, the Leidenheimer, I believe, and Adam can correct me here, but that's the bakery in New Orleans that I think makes the official po' boy loaves. But it is a New Orleans bakery. Po' boy, of course, is the sandwich that everyone gets in New Orleans, and people are as jazzed about that bread as the specific, like, people are super jazzed about banh mi loaves. But anyway, Adam, you have anything on this?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting thought because it's not really a question in the realm of health or like flavor, because typically those banh mi's and those kind of French bread things aren't known for flavor, but known for textures. So it really sounds like this guy's trying to achieve a certain texture. I wouldn't want to speak on behalf of specific bakeries, you know, on what they're using, but oftentimes, those kind of more industrialized products use a bromated mixture. So they bromate the flour, which is a sodium bromate, which is illegal to use in a lot of European nations. But we embrace it here in the U.S. It's like a dough fixer. It helps things rise and also helps with the coloring in the crust. That would be one way to go about it, is to use bromated flour for your texture, because we're talking about texture here. The other way is to use some malt. There's dry malts. There's a couple versions, but I prefer using the malt that kind of looks like honey, almost like a syrup. A little bit of sugar goes a long way in a crust or texture. So I once had it described that the crispiness of those banh mi breads should almost sound like walking on, you know, like fresh laid snow, that little bit of crunch. So that comes from having a little bit of sugar inside the dough. If you're not using a dough enhancer such as bromated flour, get into the sugar realm a little bit, try that. And then also before you bake, you can let crust start to form on your dough. So make sure it's exposed to air for a certain amount of time before you bake it. And that'll also give a little bit more crispiness, but can make your bread a little more dense. So it's a slippery slope.
Right. So I'm reading the ingredients here that are on one of them. And it looks like it's got wheat gluten, so that's going to increase rise, but also going to take a little more water and make it harder to work with, right?
For sure.
It's got also whey and milk powder. That's going to make it brown more, right?
Yep, exactly.
It's got, now, as opposed to maltose to sugar, it's got diastatic malts, meaning they're adding enzymes that are also going to break down some of the starch, the broken starch, into sugar and cause the yeast to rise more dramatically. Is that correct?
Yeah, you'll get a faster rise from that kind of malt.
And then it also has ascorbic acid, which is vitamin C. What is the antioxidant thing doing in there? What's the effect of vitamin C on the bread?
So vitamin C, and also in the presence of acidity too, if you actually add different like vinegars to doughs and whatnot, is for strengthening it. It kind of helps with the overall structure strength of the dough, which will really make it more dense. It doesn't make it more elastic. It just improves the strength. So i.e. whatever the product you're eating, you're probably using a softer flour. So that way it's like a lighter feeling bread. So that way it's got like a Wonder Bread quality. And then they add vitamin C to give it a little bit more strength to achieve the crust.
Ah, that's so funny because it's counterintuitive, right? Because you think that like over acidic doughs, if it's too much acid, obviously it weakens the gluten and makes the crust not brown, but a little bit of ascorbic acid kind of goes the other direction. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, you can use it in puff pastry too. You'll see some people do that. That was where I first learned how to use it.
Huh, cool. All right. Now we have from One Manic Ninja, Phil Bravo.
Hi to all of you out there in the far-flung reaches of Heritage Radio. I just bought a bag of beans called horse gram from my local Indian grocery store. They're tiny beans, and they vary in color from dark brown all the way to light tan, but unfortunately, so are the rocks that are hidden among the beans. Rinsing them in a colander has proven to be futile, as both the beans and the rocks are roughly the size of mung beans. I've picked over the dry beans and then soaked them and picked them over again just to be sure. After pressure cooking, the beans are soft but remain intact, and you just can't tell when you spooned up a rock until you crunch one between your molars. Is there some magic bean cleaning trick that I can try, or, as I have no horse, should I just throw them out to avoid breaking a tooth during this global pandemic? Love the show, and grateful that y'all keep on keeping on during these trying C-19 times.
Wow, Phil. Adam, before you answer that, I know some of that's the last one of the ones that we're having read by callers. I want to thank Phil. I want to thank Mike. I want to thank Rachel. I want to thank Jordana for reading those questions for us and doing the tests. We appreciate it. And Adam, the reason I had them read this one for you is because when you're buying wheat at home, sorting your wheat is another thing you're going to have to do, wheat or rye. And so I thought maybe you could talk about that as well.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So here's the thing that is also kind of breaking that fourth wall of the romance of baking and cooking is, you know, much like, you know, I always talk about it with grandmothers, how people really adore grandmothers, but at one point they weren't grandmothers and probably did some pretty evil things. So don't always trust those sneaky no-nos. Same thing is with farmers. We have this sort of adornment with all farmers, and as we should. I mean, they do feed us, and it's kind of the most important job, one of, on the planet. But, you know, there's a way to make ends meet, and there's certain farms that aren't really run by an individual and more of a larger company. And it all comes down to their care for the product. So with grain specifically, like wheat, I always look at the grain before I buy it and kind of just mull over it. A few things you can learn just from looking at it with just a regular, like say, bread making wheat, whether it's hard or soft or spring or winter. Look at if they are all the same size. If they're all the same size, then probably the seed that was used is more or less a seed that wasn't made for flavor, but was bred for production. So they're all kind of uniform, which will let you know that they won't have too many interesting flavors going on, kind of just one. But also, if you look past that, if you see stones in your grain, then that means they're not using a seed cleaner, which kind of just sorts everything out. There's 120, 130-year-old equipment and patents out there on how to separate these things. So you don't have to separate all the rocks at home, except for maybe the errant one here or there. So if your beans are full of stones to the point where you're nervous of ruining your teeth, I would absolutely throw them in the bin and get a better quality bean, a bean that someone loved and someone cared about and was like, which separate the stones out for you before they get there. So that way when you check out, you know, if there's some stones, there's maybe only just one or two. Because if it's full of stones, then the farming practice really didn't take the time to clean it or take care of it, which means other things could be in there, other things that you don't want, or even in the growing process before. Who knows if your beans were just blasted with pesticide? And that would be worse than eating a rock, I imagine. So it just kind of means that someone didn't care for the beans. They're probably an inexpensive bean. And the jump in bean quality price isn't all that much. I wouldn't mind paying $4 a pound as opposed to $2 if it meant you get to stay out of the dentist.
Right. And there's different ways that people separate things out commercially, right? So you can separate based on weight, and there are machines that separate based on density, and that's, by the way, how you're supposed to get rid of them stones, because the odds that they weigh the exact same, they have a similar density to the bean, relatively low. Another way is based on size, and so, for instance, I had a sack of organic warthog wheat from a relatively small producer, and clearly the classifier that they had dumped the wheat into to, you know, make sure that they weren't sending me whole rats or something like this was exactly the same size as the cracked corn that they had just classified before it. And so, like, there was all pieces of cracked corn, not a lot, like, you know, maybe out of a 25-pound bag, maybe I got like 10, 15 grams of cracked corn out of it. You know what I mean? So, you know, and like errant buckwheat groats. I know rye often has a lot of like non-rye seeds in it, right?
Yeah.
Just because that's just how it works. But yeah, I mean, sometimes these smaller producers, I think, have a tough time. But then some people like Rancho Gordo, you're paying a lot for their beans. You never find anything kind of untoward in those beans. But I'll say this. You come across what I typically do with things I don't trust beforehand is I get a full-size sheet pan, full-size, then get like a quart container, never more, and never fill it more than this, because a full-size sheet pan will take about a full quart container, and then slowly sprinkle the stuff onto a big sheet pan, and then do a Where's Waldo on the sheet pan and look around, and you'll get an idea just from one sheet pan's worth, Lana, what is hiding inside of your stuff.
Now, Dave, you know what my job was as a kid? We used to have beans and rice like 3 times a week. I had to sort through all of the beans and pull out all the rocks, and for years, from like, you know, 3 years old till 18, hated it.
Ooh. So how'd you do it?
We would put it in a bowl and then take handfuls and look through each handful and then put each bean that was a bean into the other bean bowl.
Oh, I wish I was dead.
Yeah. And the small little child hands too. So.
Oh, well, that's the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did your mom also had you polish the inside of the ammunition, like, you know, with your tiny hands? Yeah. Wow. That's rough stuff. I mean, like, you know,
so
what?
Rough.
I like that even, you know, over a decade of working together, there's still little dark secrets I can learn about you. It's amazing.
I know.
Yeah. But another thing you should sort people, and I said this on the show before, pistachio nuts and coffee. I do the same thing with green coffee. Like, I don't care how good your supplier is of green coffee. The odds that you don't have some of those stinker beans, like horribly molded or crazy beans. So anything like that that's like not quote unquote natural or like from like some sort of small thing and hasn't gone through some sort of industrial process, until I trust that specific batch, I always do at least one sheet tray full of stuff to look at it and see where I'm going. Pistachio nuts, even the high expensive ones, you always get a couple of shrivelers. And like I've done tests on making like pistachio orgeat with unsorted pistachios versus sorted pistachios, even of expensive ones. And the one or two bad pistachios can destroy an orgeat compared to what it would be like normally. I don't know, how bad is it when you get one or two, like, you know how you get those like weird fungusy wheat things every once in a while, those little weird, black wheat kernels? How much will one of those mess you up?
Pretty good. And actually, when you're talking about rye, one of the things to look at with rye is if it's turned pink, you'll see these little pink rye beans sometimes. And that lets you know there's fungus on the rye. And it's even harder to distinguish because it's the same size. But it's definitely good advice to look through those things, look through any kind of organic granule, anything.
You're going to write a young adult boy novel called The Fungus in the Rye?
Oh, yeah. Reckless? Of course. Yeah. Being misunderstood in a field of wheat, for sure.
Yeah. All right, now, we're going in the... Oh, Jesus, it's not even one yet. What's wrong with you people? All right, I'm going to rip through this, Adam. Feel free to chime in on this. We got a question on Instagram from @Foxwoods. What's Dave's take on negative percolation, how much flavor extraction, safety, etc.? Now, this is a post on Instagram. You can look it up, Antonio_bartender, who is Antonio Filippini. I know him. And what he does is he takes dry ice, throws it into a mocha pot. And for those of you, mocha pot are those like aluminum stovetop coffee makers. And so then he throws in the dry ice, he throws in the vanilla syrup and the alcohol, and into the percolation basket puts coffee. Then the dry ice chills and pressurizes the bottom container, which we normally do on the stove. It pushes the stuff up and over through the coffee and then makes an espresso martini, which he then pours into a glass. Apparently also the glass has dry ice. Look, if it tastes good, I don't think it's going to blow up because those things are inherently not sealed and there's an overpressure safety. It makes me a little bit nervous because anytime you're putting freezing stuff in, freezing water can block all the safeties and cause there to be problems. So it makes me a little bit nervous, but there are multiple safeties. So it only makes me, as long as gas is coming out of it, if gas wasn't coming out of it, I would be excessively worried. But if as long as it's currently venting, I don't think it's going to explode. So I think it's okay. But I never think it's an okay idea to serve dry ice to people. You got any espresso martini ideas, guys? Okay. Steven DeSena writes in from Chicago regarding Topo Chico Seltzer. I'm a big fan of Topo Chico, both for cocktail applications and for general drinking. It seems to be more strongly carbonated and retain bubbles longer than other similar products, even long after the bottle is open, and definitely outperforms the water I carbonate with my own CO2 rig. What's the best way to achieve this at home, if it's even possible? Does it have anything to do with the glass bottle packaging? Well, the glass bottle, by the way, is a lot better for long-term storage than anything else. Once you're going to store something, it better be in glass because the plastic just leaks CO2. Any advice on how to achieve something similar at home would be much appreciated, Stephen from Chicago. So the deal with Topo Chico is, first of all, if you want that high level of carbonation, you need to get rid of all of the gas that's in the water before you do it. So, in general, what we do is we do multiple carbonations, like 4 or 5 carbonation runs if you really care about it, and that'll blast out all of the gas. Commercially, what they do is they suck a vacuum on the water to suck all of the oxygen and nitrogen, everything out of it, and then replace it all with CO2. And then they use a much higher pressure. So you need very highly filtered water so it has no nucleation sites. You need then very clean glassware so that it's not nucleating. You need to get all of the gas out beforehand and you need to pressurize to a higher level. Stas, good enough?
Yep.
All right. Elvin Young wrote in about – you got anything on that, Adam, or no? What are you going to say?
No, it's good.
All right.
Dave, don't you want to continue with bread stuff since you have 4 minutes, or you want to go to
There's no more bread stuff. I'm ripping through the non-bread
stuff. Oh, I thought you wanted to talk to him about stuff from his book. Okay,
I do, but I'm going
to
do that at the very end. Hold on a sec. Elvin Young wrote in about cocktails. I'll get you next week, Elvin, when we have more time for cocktails. And Elysio wrote in about Instagram on Classics in the Field. I appreciate your comments. We'll do that next week when we do Classics in the Field again, because today's Classic in the Field is the Flower Lab, which you should go buy. Although, God dang it, Adam, you can't get that thing on Amazon. Anything bread-related, you can't get on Amazon right now.
I didn't know that. You know,
buy it from you have to buy the EPUB copy. Did you know that apparently your book is great on Kindle, in quotes, great on Kindle, and that if I buy your book on Kindle for, I don't know, like $16, they'll give me $11 in credit to buy some other ratty Kindle book. Did you know that?
I didn't. I mean, that sounds like a great deal.
Yeah, now it is a great deal. Now you know, and knowing in this case is all the battle. Now I'm going to pepper you with some bread questions like Nastasia told me to. Okay, listen, your sourdough slash, how do you pronounce Levan anyway? Levan? How do you say it? Levain? Levan? Who?
Levan, that's what I always say.
Levan? Levan?
Yeah.
John, Mr. Frenchman, how do you pronounce it?
Levan.
Ah, you. All right. So your recipe for that is rather professional in the sense that you got to feed the sucker every 12 hours, like, if you're going to use it. You're like, yeah, you could keep it in the fridge for like a week, but then the day before you're going to use it, you better start feeding it every 12 hours or you're a jerk. Is there a way to make a home-friendly, like, sourdough or levain that doesn't need a full 24 hours to come back up, but that only requires that you bake once a week?
Yes, you can take a levain from the fridge and mix it directly in and make bread. It's just that your dough is going to take a really long time to ferment because everything is in a slower state. But you could go right from the fridge into a dough, and instead of, say, 6 hours of total fermentation, it'll end up being 10 or 12 on its own. But that'll cut out the 12 hours or 24 hours of bringing your levain back. The bread won't be as of high quality. That's why I really try to tell anyone that's baking at home, if you're looking to just have bread because you like bread and it's like part of your diet, don't be afraid of yeast, especially if you have a mill and you're making flour. Because you'll still get a lot of flavor. You can still use yeast. You can ferment it overnight or 2 days, or you can really control the schedule. So don't be afraid of just buying some commercial yeast. But in order to really have a levain work properly, you're going to have to bring it back.
Yeah. What's the difference in quality, by the way? Like, what's, when you say slightly lower quality, like what is the effect going to be flavor-wise?
Quality is an interesting word, but when you use a wild yeast, you get many different strands of bacteria working all together. So you get a layered flavor, whereas if you use a commercial yeast, you're only really buying one or two different kind of bacteria strands, and you're only going to get that flavor profile. So you just get more flavor from a wild yeast.
And also from a starter that you've let come back up to room temperature and feed twice before you use it?
Yeah, exactly. Because then you're getting rid of all the dead yeast cells, which are not as pleasant to digest. You're replenishing it with a new food source. And so then you're adding in living organisms as opposed to partially living, some dead, into the bread.
You just reminded me of the DMX quote, "It's hard to digest with the size of the hole in your chest."
Man. Oh, it.
So listen, you mentioned it, I think, only once or twice, but other internet sources go off on the heat generated from the mill and trying to keep the flour below 110. Isn't that Fahrenheit? Don't you think that's kind of a garbage number, 110? I mean, it's not like you're going to wipe out the enzymes as soon as it goes over 110, because the milling doesn't take that long anyway.
Yeah, no, that problem is more for commercial milling, or if you were using a conical burr grinder that wasn't cooled. And it's really like, and I'm not a scientist, this was just from when I spent time at the bread lab in Seattle, and just the information from Washington State University that was given to me is that the optimal amount of enzymatic activity and everything was below, you know, 114 degrees, give or take.
Those folks are badasses, huh?
Yeah, really, really badass for sure.
The WSU bread lab people. All right, Another thing, you do something which is, I think, in the book, atypical in terms of how you do your sifting, right? So kind of like the way you see most people sifting and the way I set up my sifting rig is that I have a 40 mesh, a 50 mesh, and a 60 mesh screen, and then I put them through successively, right? And then I have like coarse, fine, finer, and flour, right?
Yeah.
You put everything through a 70, which for most people, by the way, 70, what that means, people, is 70 lines per inch, right? So, and then depending on how thin your wires are, there will be the opening space isn't necessary. That's what's messed up about using mesh sizes is they don't necessarily say what the open space or what the hole size is, which is actually more important for what we're doing than how many wires per inch there are. But whatever. So like 70 is extremely fine, like finer than any one of those, like finer than the mill people make. They do, I think, a 50 and a 60 or a 40.
Yeah, 50. 50 is pretty typical.
Yeah. So, and then you have, and you also, most people talk about extraction flour. So they'll say, I use 85% flour, meaning 85% of what I grind ends up in the flour and 15% ends up as kind of the, either I use for dusting or for whatever, right? The bran and stuff. Right. Whereas you remove everything, appears that you remove everything that won't go through a 70 mesh and then add that in as a proportion of included bran and other things. How come you go that way, and what do you think the difference between the two methods or the advantages and disadvantages of the two methods?
You know, I really thought that I think if the book was going to be successful, when I was working on fresh milled products, there wasn't any literature for me to learn. I had to really learn from working with bakers. So the problem with bran is that it cuts your gluten structure as if it's a razor blade. So if you separate, inherently with stone milling, there's always going to be an amount of bran present no matter how fine you go. So that's a good thing. There's a lot of flavor in bran. There's a lot of nutrients. So by taking out the larger flakes of bran in the beginning, you now have a control, of building the structure of the dough. And with a lot of these, you know, higher hydration, more artisanal loaves, there's a lot of folding going on after quite a bit of strength has been built. So to incorporate the bran later, you're going to get all of the health benefits, the flavor benefits, but you'll also have the structure. So by completely separating it, you can choose in what realm of a product that you want to produce. And that's important more and more. Like, probably bread is the easiest to do, honestly. You can make a bread without any sifting at all. But if you want to make a really nice puff pastry, you're trying to capture all the gas from the butter melting at a high temperature. And all those milk solids going up. So a piece of bran cutting a hole in your dough is not going to help that. So you're going to need to extract, but you can then add the bran back in later or add it to the butter itself. And it just gives you a tool on how to get closer to 100% use of the grain that you're buying.
But do you see a big, like, once you've removed it, so like a 70 is going to get rid of almost anything, right? But yeah. Then do you see there to be a big difference between, for instance, the stuff that is in between a 40 and a 50 versus the stuff that's in between a 50 and a 60 versus the stuff that's excluded by a 40? Is there, and there's like, does the size of those fractions, which is a huge difference for a user to feel in their fingers, are all of those fractions equally, as you say, small knife cutting, or the finer they are, the less of an effect they have?
There's quite a bit of scientific information on that subject. Where is it, even down to the milling process, is it better for dough structure at any inclusion to be stone milled or burr ground? Because a stone mill kind of crushes it and, you know, kind of, like I said, permanently bonds the bran to a lot of the germ and starch. Or where a burr grinder actually slices, keeping the grain sliced almost evenly, you can have a better form of separation, which also is why people do roller mills for large production, is because it's really easy to separate the bran. But incrementally, as it gets smaller, the finer, if you're going in between, say, very fine and very coarse, it would be better to go very coarse to get the bran off in a larger piece to completely fully exclude it out. But between, say, 50, 60, 40, it's not a whole world of difference for hands-on bread making or dough making as far as that effect of shortening the gluten strands.
Cool. Now, one more. The home mills, like the $300 style home mill, whether you're going to get a mock mill or whether you're going to get a Como or one of these other things. And like I said, you're not a fan of, and neither have I been a fan of, any of the kind of metal burr grain mills that are out there. Are those, that style, that 300 and change dollar style of mill, are they going to get you the same kind of results, if as long as you're willing to spend the time, that you could get out of the kind of your bakery level mill?
Yeah, I was using, that's very recent that they've achieved that. In 2012, I was using a 8-inch stone industrial mill, and to get that quality really wasn't until the last 3 or 4 years with the mock mill, which has like a 1 or 2 inch stone. The material is the same, synthetic stone, and the distance between the runner stone and the bed stone, the stone that moves and the stone that stays, is now so easy to dial in that I prefer the small home mill, and I use it for all the baking at the restaurant now, because it just takes up less space. And the bread making process is so long anyway that you can schedule milling, you know, to work with your, with, you know, how you're operating. So the size of the mill isn't all that important until you really scale up and you just need a lot more flour.
Now,
all right. So everyone should go on Caviar and order. You can order Adam's flour and his starter, and you can order bread, and you can order pasta, and you can order all that stuff if you live in New York City. So do that. Support a restaurant that's open.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
Appreciate having you on. Stas, you want to get this Caviar again? Is where you're going?
Yeah, you're going to order from Sophia's, S-O-F-I-A apostrophe S, right, Adam?
Yep.
On Go Caviar.
And you want to give them your social, or people can ping back on you, Adam, and let them know about your bread talk show ideas?
Social security is what he's talking about.
Yeah, Adam. Yeah. It's 057. It's at Adam Leonti. That's it. Just my name.
Yeah. All right. Adam, thanks a lot. Thanks for being on the show. And thanks again to our readers for reading the questions. See you next week.
Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.